Greetings, this is Future Sam from the future, future where I'm editing this podcast. Welcome to our Ezekiel episode. I have a little bit of a warning. I recorded this episode when I had a cold, and my emotions may have been a bit raw, because I have some serious unresolved anger problems against a prophet who has been dead for 2,500 years. And I may have used this episode slightly as a bit of personal therapy to try to figure out how to deal with my Ezekiel emotions. But first, we dig deep into one of Amanda's favorite passages in the Bible, which is the first two chapters of the book of Ezekiel, which are strange and over the top and weird and crazy, and it's just the Bible at its most delightful. Let's dig. I am the man that has seen affliction by the rod of God's wrath. I remember my affliction, my wandering, the bitterness and the gall, I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope.
Welcome to the Broken Book Podcast. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Sam, and we're ready again this week to appreciate, dissect, criticize, defend, and generally nerd out about the Bible.
The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kabar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of the Lord was on him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. And in that cloud, Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air.
Amanda!
Ezekiel saw the wheel. I mean, that's how the song goes, right?
Yes.
Okay, the center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in that fire was what looked like four living creatures. So these four living creatures, they each have four faces. One of them is a human, one is a lion, one is an ox, and one is an eagle. And they also have two wings that are flying, and two wings that are covering their body.
So the idea is that these cool cherub things would have the understanding of a human and the strength of a lion. Apparently the ox is viewed as having a good work ethic, and the eagle's really fast and very, very good at flying.
And seeing.
So these were kind of the exemplar animals of the animal kingdom.
Right. Or you could say humans are the head of the whole animal creation, and the lion is the king of the wild beasts, the ox is the king of the domestic beasts, and the eagle is the king of the birds.
Put them together, one badass angel.
Exactly. And each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, without turning as they went. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. Which Sam is still super confused about, how they're, like, not turning as they're going in different directions and stuff.
Yeah, they're supposed to be able to be really mobile, these angels, but they're not allowed to move. I'm so confused.
Well, I think the idea is that there's one face in each of the cardinal directions, so whenever they're going north, they just use their north face. And then whenever they're going east, they use their east face.
And whenever they want to go diagonal, they're screwed.
Well, Ezekiel wasn't thinking about that part.
Maybe that's what the wheel's for.
So there's also these wheels that are described as a wheel intersecting a wheel. So there's different interpretations, but the interpretation that I like of the way that the wheels work is that it's like you have two circles, and then you take one and flip it like 90 degrees, but
it's like sticking a donut into the middle of another donut.
If we could show you a picture, you would understand immediately.
And the other interpretation usually is just that rings are kind of interconnected.
Like chain links.
So the spirit's connecting the wheels to the really weird angel things. And oh, the wheels are covered in eyeballs.
Yeah, we forgot about that part. The wheels are covered with eyes. Which sounds super creepy, but I think the symbolism there is really just supposed to be that they're, like, all-seeing. And there's a later passage in Ezekiel that says that the wings and the creatures have eyes all over them, too.
Which is an older tradition going back to the prophet Isaiah.
When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved. And when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels.
Here's what really confuses me. What are the wheels actually doing? Because you have all these angels flying, and they're connected to these wheels, but the wheels sound like dead weight to me.
Well, I mean, I think the thing is, Ezekiel is not an engineer, and so he was like, hey, it's this thing that is like this awesome machine that, like, takes you places, so it must have wheels. That's my interpretation.
So his assumption was that because chariots have wheels, flying machines must have wheels, but he has no idea where to actually put the wheels, so he just had them kind of floating underneath everything.
That's my thought. I mean, airplanes have wheels. Maybe they're the landing gear.
Yes, I'm sure that was his intent.
Spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked something like a vault, sparkling like crystal and awesome. Above the vault, over their heads, was what looked like a throne of lapis lazuli, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire, and that from there down, he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a radiant day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness, of the glory, of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking.
Pause. Okay, seriously, why do we picture God as being an old white dude with a big bushy beard when we can picture metal fire superhero with rainbows? This is such a cooler way of picturing God. So, what on earth is this passage about?
Good question. We should also say what this passage is. This is the first chapter of the book of Ezekiel, which is our topic today.
And it's basically a description of a flying machine.
Yes. Which is super important because Ezekiel is written right before and during the destruction of the temple, right after the Babylonians have taken a lot of the Judeans into exile, and so they don't have contact with the temple anymore.
So if God can fly, that means God's no longer trapped in one physical location. God gets mobile.
Yeah. When the temple's destroyed, God isn't destroyed with it.
God can be anywhere and everywhere and all seeing and all moving, with lots and lots of eyeballs.
Moving like a flash of lightning.
Badass.
Pretty scary.
So, when Isaiah meets God, he just goes into the temple, and there's a throne, and there's God, and Isaiah talks to God. But it's a little more difficult for Ezekiel, because
Ezekiel's in Babylon, right? By the Kabar River in the land of the Babylonians.
Ezekiel sees the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. He's not seeing God directly. He's not talking to God directly. He's like seeing the, I don't know, carbon copy of the reflection of the idea of the email of God. It's so disconnected. Because at this point, God has become so transcendent, so other, that it's impossible for Ezekiel to directly encounter him as a person.
What a change from Moses speaking to God face to face.
Now you can just talk to the adjective of the adjective of the adjective describing. Wait, that would be the adverb of the adverb of the adverb describing the adjective of God. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much disconnection. And thus begins the trippiest book of the Bible.
So I think we need a bit of a recap here.
So before the exile, the Judeans are extremely focused on the temple. The temple isn't a metaphor for God. The temple is where God lives. That's where his presence is felt. And as long as the temple stands, Israel will never fall. Except Israel does fall, and the temple is destroyed, and that entire way of life just gets blown up. And there's so many different ways of reacting to the exile we see in different books. Like, we have Deuteronomistic history, where people go back through their history and shame themselves, realizing everything they've done wrong ever. So it's not God's fault, it's our fault that this exile happened. Mm-hmm. You have the Book of Lamentations, where God is slightly called out for the crap, and the author goes as far as to accuse God of being an enemy, of being openly ignorant and unjust. And perhaps one of the weirdest reactions comes from the prophet Jeremiah, who internalizes all the pain in Israel into himself and kind of psychologically tortures himself as a way of expressing the torture and torment of Israel. And he gets desperately, desperately afraid of God, but he still feels compelled to share God's message. And then there's Ezekiel. And Ezekiel's just kind of okay with it.
Yeah. Well, see, I didn't get that impression when I was reading Ezekiel at first. Ezekiel actually reads a lot like other biblical books. He says, like, a lot of similar things about the people having done things wrong and God is punishing them. But you can actually see the difference between Ezekiel and some other books like Jeremiah or Isaiah when you notice what Ezekiel isn't doing.
Ezekiel, it seems totally okay with everything that's happening. If Israelites are dying, he just accepts it. If people go into exile, he accepts it. In fact, he sees God's presence in his own suffering.
True, but not where I was going. The reason that you feel like he is just accepting what's happening is because he's so very much not protesting. Like, in all the other books, there's so much protest.
He doesn't challenge God. He doesn't shake his fist at God. He accepts it. In fact, Ezekiel is fed the scroll of destruction by God, and he thinks it tastes sweet, like honey. Ezekiel is almost happy, cheerful, giddy, to proclaim the judgment and terror of the Lord.
Yeah, there's a lot of other prophets who do ultimately give prophecies of destruction to Israel, but before they do that, they often stand up to God for Israel. You know, they're like, hey God, can I whittle you down? Like, if there's a couple good folks, will you, like, please not destroy the city? Or like, hey God, you shouldn't destroy this people because you just saved them and it'll make you look bad if they suddenly get destroyed.
There's an attempt to kind of manipulate God into doing Israel's will. Even Amos, who thinks everything's going to get blown up, Amos still tries to argue Israel's case and plead for mercy. He just kind of gives up halfway through the book. But Ezekiel is on God's side. Ezekiel isn't trying to present an alternative human perspective. Ezekiel sees himself as the prophet of the Lord, speaking only God's words, and is trying to avoid inserting his own opinion and interpretation.
Another thing that's different is that Israel as a whole is not offered the opportunity to be pardoned. There's parts where God says, if you repent, then I won't kill you, to individual Israelites, but there's no option for Israel as a whole to repent and save itself from destruction.
Future history is already set in stone. God fully intends to destroy Judah, and God will destroy Judah. An individual person might be saved or damned because of their actions, but the greater course of human events, what happens to nations, what happens to the world, is already been decided.
Another difference that I thought was interesting is that Ezekiel isn't promised protection from God. He isn't promised that God's presence will be with him. When Moses gets his call, he tries to turn it down a bunch of times, and God's like, no, no, like, A, you're gonna do this, and B, don't be worried because I'll be with you. And that does not happen in the book of Ezekiel. What God promises Ezekiel is that he'll make Ezekiel stubborn enough to keep butting heads with the rebellious Israelites. But he doesn't promise him that he'll be protected from them. He just promises him that he'll continue being stubborn enough to continue butting heads with them.
So God gives this kind of speech about how pig-headed the Israelites are, and the response is, but I'll make you even more pig-headed so you can stand up to them. So I imagine a bunch of conversations that go absolutely nowhere with Ezekiel.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
There's this constant refrain throughout the book of Ezekiel where God lists a bunch of things he's going to do, many of which involve lots and lots and lots of destruction and death. And he ends, I will do this, and you will know that I am the Lord. God's identity is based on God's actions, including God's violent actions. And God reveals himself through what happens in history. It's less that God's intervening in history and more that God almost is history.
So one example where God tells Ezekiel to do something that most prophets would probably complain about is Ezekiel gets told that his wife is going to die and that he's not allowed to mourn for her when she does.
Instead, Ezekiel is going to go around and basically brag to the other Israelites, "Look, I'm not mourning the death of my wife. That's going to show you that you shouldn't be mourning either. You're not even going to have time to mourn." He turns his own suffering into a publicity stunt to make a political point to the Israelites. It's like Ezekiel gives up his humanity to the cause of God. Ezekiel describes how much he loved his wife, calling her the light of his eyes. But nope, God has a different plan. We can't question it, we can't judge it, and we can't mourn it. It's set in stone. "Then you will know that I am the Lord." In a lot of ways, Ezekiel is using the same kind of philosophy that Deuteronomistic history uses, is that if the Judeans are doing well, God will bless them. If Judeans are doing badly, God will curse them. And there's a sense that it's good and lovely and awesome when God blesses you, and it's unfortunate and bad when God curses you. Mm-hmm. Ezekiel seems to think it's good when God destroys you and curses you, because that's what God wants to do. It's that everything that God decides to do should be glorified and taste sweet, because that is the will of God. So you don't have that sense of mourning over Israel's failures, because that would be mourning and second-guessing a decision made from God.
So the one time when Ezekiel actually protests what God is telling him to do is when it involves ritual purity. So there's this one part where God is like, "Hey, Ezekiel, you have to lie on your side for like a year and cook your food while you're lying on your side on a little fire. And so you got to set aside your food that you're going to cook for like a year, you know, next to you so you can cook it on the fire. And, oh yeah, the fire has to be made out of your own poop." And Ezekiel's like, "You know, I'm chill with, like, lying on my side for a year and, like, cooking on a fire that's, like, right next to my face while I'm lying on my side. But, like, can I please use cow poop instead of people poop? Because people poop is impure and I wouldn't want to, you know, not be clean. That would be terrible."
Yeah, so Ezekiel's all fine with the genocide, all fine with the exile, all fine with destructions of temples. But, yeah, he crosses the line when it comes to burning human shit. Because that's not clean, dude.
Yeah.
It's an obsession with purity rather than an obsession with justice.
Right, right. Some of the prophets that have been pretty harsh, like Amos seems, I don't know about happy about destruction, but seems pretty sure that Israel is going to be destroyed. But his main concern is that people are being very unjust.
Mean to the poor. Mean to the foreigners, the orphans.
And the widows. And Ezekiel pretty much doesn't talk about that stuff.
A little bit.
A little bit, here and there.
Yeah, but it's not the central focus. It's not about you're being mean to people. It's about there's too much menstrual fluid or too much human shit. Or you're not cleaning the temple properly. It's all this etiquette.
Ezekiel's more focused on whether or not you're keeping the rules. And maybe less focused on whether or not you're following the spirit of the rules.
And that becomes a gradual trend in later biblical texts.
So Sam likes to call Ezekiel's God, or at least where Ezekiel's God is sort of heading toward, reality God.
Because it's a really kind of a new apotheosis. God can't be the apotheosis of Judea anymore. He doesn't represent Judean flourishing, because there's no Judah. So what is God an apotheosis of now? Where does God's strength come from? What is God representing? For Ezekiel, it seems like God makes his presence known by what actually happens. Something happens, then you will know that I am the Lord. So God represents historical movement, which means that God represents everything that happens, which means that God kind of represents reality itself, which is such a bigger God. is such a more powerful God, because literally nothing can ever happen without it coming from God, because the definition of something happening is that it is, and that's what God is, and...
No one can ever do something against what God wants to happen, because by definition, if it happens, it's what God wanted to happen.
And here we see a really modern God, a really omnipotent, omnipresent, mobile God, omniscient. This is
the flying machine with the eyeballs.
Yeah, that's our first kind of vision of classical theism. The all, truly all-powerful God, and truly a universal God. This God might have a special relationship with Israel, but this is not the God of Israel. This is the God of the world, the universe. And in a lot of ways, God is the apotheosis of the universe.
So in a lot of ways, as we were discussing this podcast ahead of time, we realized that Sam especially, but we tend to view Ezekiel as sort of like a bad guy, to be honest.
Ezekiel is my bad guy. He's my antagonist. Like, if you're going to write the story of Sam, Ezekiel is he's my Voldemort. He's so fucking obsessed with purity. And he doesn't seem to care about actual people actually getting hurt. He cares more about his own shit than he does about his wife. And I'm sorry, some of that is seeped into religious tradition and culture. This is, like, some of the origins of obsessions with racial purity and sexual purity and trying to look Christian rather than being Christian, where the appearance matters more than the actions, where laws and rules matter more than results.
I was at Pride while we were working on this episode, and there are some Christians who were there to protest Pride, which... In Grand Rapids is more of a big deal because Pride isn't as established, and it's more painful. And this was right after the shooting in Orlando. To see people protesting was just very hurtful. And here in Ezekiel, we find this passage where Ezekiel is told that he's responsible to tell other people that they're wrong. If he doesn't tell people that they're wrong, then he's responsible for what happens to them. But if at least he tells them that they're wrong, then he's sort of absolved of guilt. And I see that same sort of mindset in these protesters where they're not really concerned about, like, or it doesn't, they're not being strategic about how might one win a gay person to Christ.
It's about pointing out that this gay person is sinning.
Right, right.
And that same as in Ezekiel's, it doesn't matter if you actually get someone to stop sinning. You just have to judge them and tell them that they're doing wrong.
Right.
That makes you look good.
You just have to have a hard enough head that you keep slamming your head against other people's heads.
Being self-righteous matters more than even being effective or creating a force of good in the world. Which kind of makes sense if you're dealing with reality God, actually.
Another thing we really don't like about Ezekiel is... Ezekiel sort of exemplifies this really sad thing about Deuteronomistic history, which is that the people of Israel, when Israel is invaded and the temple is destroyed, they have this idea of God that doesn't make sense with what's happening to them. And they sort of have a choice. They can either say, well, I guess God maybe isn't real or isn't as strong as we thought, or they can say, I guess we actually deserve to be punished by God. And they end up sort of sacrificing themselves to keep their God. They end up saying, yeah, like, all these things that all of our kings did were totally wrong and messed up, and God was totally right to punish us. So they kept this idea of God being just, and in order to do that, they had to see themselves as terrible.
They had to dehumanize themselves.
Right. And I think Sam and I both have a vision that God would be one who would sacrifice God's self for humanity.
Yeah.
Rather than requiring, rather than requiring humans to sacrifice their humanity for God.
Yeah, Jesus had to come in to fix a lot of Ezekiel's shit. So it has all the stuff I don't like about Deuteronomistic history, and that combines with all the stuff I don't like about Ezra, Nehemiah, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, like the post-exilic texts, because those are the texts which care less about justice. It cares way more about purity, especially like racial purity. So it matters more that you aren't married to a Gentile than that you're actually nice to your wife. And also, Ezekiel's kind of the start of apocalyptic literature, where prophecy becomes less about real events and real history, and a little bit more about very magical, very supernatural craziness that will happen that is completely beyond any human agency. So, in a lot of ways, Ezekiel takes the elements I dislike from the entire Old Testament and just shoves it into one book.
So there's also an element of redemption in Ezekiel, that God is going to sort of take Israel and punish Israel and purify Israel and then bring Israel back better. But the thing about it is that this is all God doing this. The humans don't get to participate. They're sort of just objects that God acts upon and either removes them to purify Israel or lets them stay.
Yeah, humans aren't the point. God's the point. God's the one in control. That's why Ezekiel doesn't stand up to God. Because Ezekiel's job is to submit to God. So when he's fed the scroll of destruction, that's why it tastes like honey. Because that's how you're supposed to respond to destruction. Mmm, sweet.
Unlike Jeremiah, who's like, oh, this is a fire in my bones. It's the most painful thing ever, but I can't stop myself from saying it.
Well, Jeremiah is willing to admit his own emotions.
Right.
And he writes down his own emotions, and he cries out to God and knows he can't be helped, while Ezekiel's, like, whistling.
Yeah.
Ezekiel sees himself as a mouthpiece of God rather than an advocate for humanity to God. And
part of the reason that he's not an advocate to God is because God is just simply less personal. There aren't really passages where Ezekiel's talking to God. There's parts where God is talking to Ezekiel, but there aren't really parts, apart from the poop part, where Ezekiel is talking back to God.
Of course you can't talk back to God, because God, and Ezekiel actually says that God's more abstract, because it's, you know, the lightness of the glory of the abstraction of the outline of the paraphrase of God, rather than God. Ezekiel's God is a God of the philosophers, rather than a human-like God. Ezekiel just represses his emotions. He thinks everything God does has to be good and glorious. He's obsessed with purity. I see everything I dislike about the Judeo-Christian tradition kind of tattooed in by Ezekiel. Legalism, dogmatism, fatalism, an unhealthy sense of inferiority to God, an unhealthy sense of guilt.
An unhealthy sense of superiority over other people and thinking that you know what God says.
And the very notion that we should be okay with tons of people getting damned. That it's okay that so many people go to hell. Earlier prophets really had issues with destruction. Earlier prophets are better than a lot of modern Christians who are okay with the notion of people going to hell. Not that hell was a concept at this point yet, but you still see the outlines of kind of God being glorified by the damnation of sinners.
Sure. Hell and damnation in this case are just people being killed.
Yeah. But it's not a stupid God. Ezekiel's God kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think we have to come back to the theme of having empathy for biblical books.
But Amanda, it's Ezekiel.
Still in the Bible. Still a person.
Okay. What can we empathize with from Ezekiel?
Well, I think the low-hanging fruit here is just, you always need to have empathy for refugees and displaced people. And this is Ezekiel, the refugee, who's been displaced from his home and is sitting in Babylon in a refugee camp by the river and has this understanding of God that somehow makes more of these things make sense for him.
I guess I should feel crummy because I spent several minutes criticizing a dude over how he was mourning his wife. you know? People right. mourn their own ways. It's not my job to judge. I should be pointing. Ezekiel, you're doing funerals wrong.
That's you're right.
He's a victim of his circumstance, and he has to find solace some way, and he likes to think that there's some kind of reason behind his suffering. He takes that too far, but I'm saying that as someone who isn't in a refugee camp.
Right. Another thing that's really awesome is as a person who's in the culture that's being oppressed and not the culture of power, he finds a way to fight against his culture being appropriated by the Babylonians or being indoctrinated with Babylonian culture. He finding a way to keep his god is also a way of finding a way to keep himself and keep his own culture intact.
Ezekiel is stubbornly Jewish.
Yes.
And he maintains that tradition. In some ways, that's what purity means, is to be stubbornly Jewish, to not become Babylonian or Roman or part of the Spanish Empire or American. It's to maintain our own identity. And it's true that thanks to the models of people like Ezekiel, that Judaism has been ridiculously successful of avoiding cultural appropriation and actually keeping its gods, keeping its traditions over thousands of years.
Without having political power for almost any of that time. Which is just amazing.
I guess that's God's gift of stubbornness.
Yeah, that's God's gift of stubbornness to Ezekiel.
Also, Ezekiel doesn't let God become a bad guy. Which might be healthy. You know, like the author of Lamentations kind of hates God. The author of Job arguably kind of hates God. Ezekiel isn't gonna let himself hate God, which is maybe healthy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that, but if you believe in God, having a God who isn't terrible is probably a good idea.
Yeah. Another thing is that I do think that Ezekiel's image of God as not a God just focused on one country, but a God that has a presence everywhere, sort of this big G God, makes a lot more sense if you're only going to believe in one God. If there's really only one God, then it really makes more sense if that God is the God of the universe and not just of Israel. Why would God be so focused only on Israel?
In some ways, a reality God makes more philosophical sense than worshipping a country or worshipping a tree or worshipping a river. It's not limited.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a more sophisticated form of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Not that sophisticated always means better, but still.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps more intellectually valid.
Mm-hmm.
I have another thing I have empathy for. It is, like, Ezekiel has this notion of personal salvation, so that we're not always condemned by the sins of our parents, that we get to make our own fate to an extent. And I think we've taken that too far now, where we only care about ourselves as individuals, and then we don't have a sense of corporate collective sin.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the sense of inheriting the problems of our parents and mm-hmm. problems of our society. But having a sense that we're individuals and that we are held accountable for our actions is empowering.
Yeah.
And especially must have been empowering for these people in exile who had seen that their culture had led everything to destruction. But there's still hope, because you as an individual can choose not to do that. You can rewrite your fate and rewrite your history and not make the mistakes your parents made.
We were talking about how Ezekiel has this prophecy that Judah and Israel are going to be reunited under a single king, which it's sort of hard to argue that ever happened. Israel gets totally destroyed by Assyria. They're the lost tribes of Israel. They've been assimilated into other cultures.
To become the Samaritans, who are a mongrel race, who are despised.
Right. And people, like, all over the Middle East, right? I mean, probably have some, you know, ancestors that lived in that part of Israel. But when we were talking about that earlier, I was thinking, from a New Testament perspective, you could sort of reinterpret this. If Israel has been sort of diluted into the rest of the Gentile population, then when Peter and Jesus sort of, and Paul, reintegrate Gentiles into the church. There is sort of this sense that Israel has come back and been reunited with Judah.
Because all nations have been united with Judah.
Right.
I like that.
I think what you said about not criticizing the way that people mourn was really good. Like, for instance, sometimes when something terrible happens, well, whenever something terrible happens, someone is going to come up to you and say, everything works out for the best, which is in some way Ezekiel's outlook on life here. And as destructive as that can be when someone says it at you, it can be a very comforting and peace-giving reflection when it's coming from within you. And Ezekiel is able to find peace in surrender at a time when he was powerless to stop bad things from happening to him and his people.
And sometimes that's the only thing you can do when you feel powerless, is to try to look for a higher power.
And that's exactly what Ezekiel and this sort of reality God theology does.
It is hopeful for people who don't have actual hope, I guess.
Yeah.
Just one more props to Ezekiel, which I think we have to agree with.
Uh-huh.
He's a great author. He's just amazing imagination, weird visuals. You heard the entire thing with the flying machine. That's dope.
There's also this part where there's, like, this army that's, like, just dead and, like, dry bones on the ground, and there's this, like, part where Ezekiel prophesies to the bones and they all, like, get flesh back on them and, like, stand up, and it's pretty intense. One of my favorite passages in the Bible is actually in Ezekiel. It's after the sort of boring part where he's describing all the dimensions of the new temple, because he's just, like, super into that, because he's, like, super into purity and stuff and rules. But after that part, there's this part where he goes outside of the temple and there's a river that's flowing out of the temple, and it flows into the Dead Sea. And the river turns the Dead Sea into fresh water. Which isn't a thing that would happen, right? Because you can't have, like, there's fresh water and there's salt water, and when you mix them, it's still salt water. And especially when you mix the Dead Sea with anything, it's definitely still salt water. But it's like the freshness of this water is so fresh that it's catching, and it catches the dry sea fresh. And I just love that image of something that's so alive and so good that it catches the world alive and catches the world good.
Ezekiel ends on a really beautiful note of a beautiful paradise, which he thinks is going to come. And that is very hopeful. Even if it doesn't come from human agency, even if it seems so supernatural, it's still a delight to imagine. But before I give too many props to Ezekiel, I need to remind you why he's my bad guy. Because that future paradise doesn't have foreigners. It's not that God is even going to lead an army and destroy every other country. It just, basically, all the other people just get gotten rid of somehow. The non-Israelites vanish, and the Judeans rule the earth. Everyone else, I guess, gets raptured away or something.
The bad type of rapture.
The bad type of rapture. That exclusivistic heaven.
Mm.
Heaven for the us, but not the them. I am the man that has seen affliction by the rod of God's wrath. I remember my affliction, my wandering, the bitterness and the gall, I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Why should the living complain when punished for their sins? Let us lift up our hearts and our hands to God in heaven and say, we have sinned and rebelled, and you have not forgiven. You have covered yourself with anger and pursued us. You have slain without pity. You have covered yourself with clouds that no prayer can get through. You have made a scum and refuse among the nations.
all our enemies have opened their mouths wide against us. We have suffered terror and pitfalls, ruin and destruction. Streams of tears flow from my eyes because my people are destroyed. My eyes will flow unceasingly without relief until the Lord looks down from heaven and sees.